I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
中国人民有权问.
The Chinese people have every right to ask, why does the U.S. talk at length about respecting sovereignty and territorial integrity on Ukraine while disrespecting China's sovereignty and territorial integrity on the Taiwan question? Why does the U.S. ask China not to provide weapons to Russia while it keeps selling arms to Taiwan?
As the Chinese parliament unanimously votes to give Xi Jinping a third five-year term as president, tensions continue to escalate between the United States and China, in part over Taiwan. At the brink of war in the Pacific? That's the headline of a new piece by historian Alfred McCoy. We'll speak with him. Then, progressive Democratic Congressmember Barbara Lee was the sole vote against military action in the days after 9/11. Now she's running for the U.S. Senate.
I didn't quit when I refused to give the president completely unlimited war powers after September 11th, and in the face of countless death threats. I was the only no vote. I didn't quit then, and I won't quit now.
If elected, Congressmember Lee would be just the third black woman to serve in the Senate's 233-year history. We'll speak with her about President Biden's proposed $6.8 trillion budget that would increase military spending. She's introduced the People Over Pentagon Act to cut $100 billion from the military budget and reallocate funds to overlook priorities like health care and education. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's unveiled his $6.8 trillion budget proposal for the 2024 fiscal year. The plan would begin the process of trimming $3 trillion from the federal deficit over the next decade by raising taxes on wealthy individuals and corporations and allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices. Progressive groups praise the White House plan for investing in health care, housing and the environment while expanding free community college, early childhood education and child care. But Biden's budget also includes a request for a record-shattering $886 billion in military spending. Republican Speaker Kevin McCarthy has signaled Biden's budget will be dead on arrival on Capitol Hill. House Republicans have yet to unveil their own budget. Biden said Thursday he's prepared to negotiate with Speaker McCarthy at any time. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other leaders in Israel Thursday, where he called for an independent judiciary and for de-escalating tensions with Palestine, while reiterating the U.S.'s deep commitment to Israel's security.
But the United States also remains firmly opposed to any acts that could trigger more insecurity, including settlement expansion and inflammatory rhetoric. And we're especially disturbed by violence by settlers against Palestinians.
Secretary Austin also said he believed diplomacy was the best strategy when it comes to Iran and nuclear weapons. Israel's openly backed military action against Iran. Austin's visit comes against the backdrop of intensifying violence. Earlier today in the occupied West Bank, an Israeli settler shot dead a Palestinian man near an illegal settlement outside the city of Qalqilya. Separately, Israeli forces raided the town of Nilin near Ramallah overnight, arresting relatives of a Hamas gunman and ordering the immediate destruction of his family's home. Palestinians have condemned such demolitions as collective punishment. At least 79 Palestinians have been killed so far this year by Israeli military forces. The UN's humanitarian coordinator for Syria has condemned an airstrike by Israel on Aleppo International Airport earlier this week, which forced it to shut down, complicating humanitarian relief efforts as Syrians reel from last month's devastating earthquakes in the region. Here in the United States, a legislative push to end U.S. military interference in Syria through a war powers resolution was voted down Wednesday. The latest effort was led by Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz and supported by a bipartisan mix of progressive and far-right lawmakers. In Beijing, the Communist Party-controlled legislature confirmed Xi Jinping's historic third term as China's president. This comes amidst growing tension with the U.S., including over the issue of Taiwanese autonomy. We'll have more on this after headlines with historian Al McCoy. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, at least 36 civilians were killed overnight Wednesday in an attack blamed on rebels with the Allied Democratic Forces. The killings took place in two villages in part of the eastern DRC near the Ugandan border, where Congolese and Ugandan forces are fighting rebel groups. In Germany, eight people were killed and dozens more injured Thursday evening as a gunman opened fire on a Jehovah's Witness congregation in the city of Hamburg. Authorities say the shooter, who fatally turned the gun on himself after the massacre, was a former member of the group. This is the fourth known mass shooting in Germany since 2020. Here in the United States, the Gun Violence Archive has reported 105 mass shootings so far in 2023. In West Virginia, an empty coal train jumped its tracks and caught fire in the community of Sandstone Wednesday, injuring three workers and spilling diesel fuel into one of North America's oldest rivers. A day later, a Norfolk Southern freight train derailed in Alabama, 80 miles northeast of Birmingham. Local officials said no hazardous materials were involved in the crash. It was the third derailment of a Norfolk Southern train in the U.S. since February and came as Norfolk Southern's CEO, Alan Shaw, testified before the Senate's Environment and Public Works Committee. Shaw apologized for the derailment on February 3rd, which blanketed the town of East Palestine, Ohio, with a toxic brew of spilled chemicals and gases. But Shaw refused to commit to ending a profit maximization scheme known as precision scheduled railroading. Unions say the practice involves staff cuts, running fewer trains with larger loads, and shortcuts on maintenance. Under questioning from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, the Norfolk Southern CEO also refused to commit to granting workers seven paid sick days per year.
Will you make that commitment right now to guarantee paid sick days to all of your workers? That's not a radical demand. It really is not. Will you make that commitment, sir?
Senator, I share your focus on our employees. I will commit to continuing to discuss with them important quality of life issues.
Here in New York, prosecutors have signaled they may soon bring criminal charges against former President Donald Trump for campaign finance violations and other crimes. On Thursday, the New York Times reported Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg invited Trump to testify next week before a grand jury that's been investigating a $130,000 hush money payment Trump sent to adult film actress Stormy Daniels through an intermediary. In 2018, Trump's former personal attorney and fixer Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to charges of tax evasion, bank fraud, and lying to Congress about the hush money payments. Cohen says Trump directed him to make them through a shell company shortly before the 2016 presidential election. On Capitol Hill, a spokesperson for Mitch McConnell says the Senate minority leader is recovering from a concussion and will remain in a hospital for observation and treatment after he fell and hit his head Wednesday evening. The 81-year-old Kentucky Republican sustained the injury at a dinner for the Senate Leadership Fund's Super PAC at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Washington, D.C., formerly the Trump International Hotel. Arkansas Republican Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders has signed a law dropping a requirement that employers verify the age of children who apply to jobs. A spokesperson for Sanders told the Washington Post the provision was, quote, burdensome and obsolete. Arkansas law allows children as young as 14 to obtain work permits. Republican lawmakers in several other states, including Iowa and Minnesota, have recently advanced similar legislation. This comes after an investigation by the New York Times exposed the forced labor of unaccompanied migrant children as young as 12 at factories across the United States. To see our interview with the report's author, Pulitzer Prize winner Dana Hannah Dreyer, visit our website, democracynow.org. Here in New York, Uber and Lyft drivers have declared victory after city regulators granted a pay raise to drivers following a strike campaign. The fare raised by the Taxi and Limousine Commission announced Wednesday replaces another planned raise that was agreed to last year but blocked after a successful legal challenge by Uber. Last week, New York Taxi Workers Alliance Director Bhairavi Desai testified to the New York Taxi and Limousine Commission.
Every day that's passed, that is $1 million that we're collectively owed to this workforce, a workforce that has had to pay for every single penny of operating expenses. Uber and Lyft don't have to pay a dime. A workforce that works not only with economic risk, but also with great risk to their safety and to their life every single day.
In more news from New York, Sheldon Thomas, a 35-year-old black man from Brooklyn who was wrongfully convicted of murder, has been exonerated and freed from prison after nearly 19 years behind bars. Thomas was only 17 when he was arrested and accused of killing a 14-year-old boy in 2004. Detectives on the case misled a witness into identifying Thomas using a photo of another person with the same name. When the botched identification was brought up in court, the judge said at the time there was still probable cause to arrest Thomas because the photo had enough of a resemblance. Thomas was sentenced to 25 years to life. His exoneration follows over two dozen others after new investigations were launched by the Brooklyn District Attorney's Conviction Review Unit. And in New Jersey, a monument honoring the abolitionist hero Harriet Tubman was unveiled in Newark Thursday, replacing a statue of Christopher Columbus that was removed in 2020 as racial justice protests erupted nationwide in response to the police murder of George Floyd. Washington Park has been renamed Harriet Tubman Square. Among the guests at yesterday's ceremony were rapper Queen Latifah, who's from Newark, and Tubman's great-great-great-grandniece, Michelle Jones Galvin.
Many call her an American heroine. In our family, we simply refer to her as Aunt Harriet. She is Harriet Tubman, greatest conductor of the Underground Railroad. Aunt Harriet said, "I reasoned this out in my mind. There was one of two things I had a right to, liberty or death. If I could not have one, I would have the other. And no man should take me alive."
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, at the brink of war in the Pacific, we'll speak with historian Alfred McCoy about escalating tensions between the United States and China. Stay with us. Oakland's Toon Yards. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The Chinese parliament has unanimously voted to give Xi Jinping a third five-year term as president. Today's vote comes just months after China's Communist Party formally reelected Xi Jinping to the party's general secretary for another 5 years. This comes as tensions continue to escalate between the United States and China, in part over Taiwan. On Thursday, U.S. Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines told senators China poses the most consequential threat to U.S. national security.
In brief, the CCP represents both the leading and most consequential threat to U.S. national security and leadership globally, and its intelligence-specific ambitions and capabilities make it, for us, our most serious and consequential intelligence rival. During the past year, the threat has been additionally complicated by a deepening collaboration with Russia, which also remains an area, obviously, of intense focus for the intelligence community.
When asked if the United States would defend Taiwan militarily, Haines said, quote, "I think it's clear to the Chinese what our position is based on the president's comments." She was referring to Biden's repeated remarks that the U.S. would defend Taiwan militarily if China attacked the territory. Last week, the Biden administration approved $619 million in high-tech arms sales to Taiwan, including new missiles for its F-16 fighter jets. China's new foreign minister, Qin Gang, recently condemned the U.S. arming of Taiwan.
The Chinese people have every right to ask, why does the U.S. talk at length about respecting sovereignty and territorial integrity on Ukraine while disrespecting China's sovereignty and territorial integrity on the Taiwan question? Why does the U.S. ask China not to provide weapons to Russia while it keeps selling arms to Taiwan?
To look more at U.S.-China relations and the rising tensions over Taiwan, we're joined by Alfred McCoy, history professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His most recent book is titled To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. His new piece for Tom Dispatch is headlined At the Brink of War in the Pacific. Professor McCoy, welcome back to Democracy Now! Well, let's put that question to you. Is the U.S. at the brink of war in the Pacific with China?
Morning, Amy. We're edging ever closer to that brink. Yes, we are. Look, when history teaches us one thing, as Barbara Tuchman said in her famous book, The Guns of August, referring to August of 1914, trying to explain how the great powers fought a war that nobody wanted, World War I. And basically what she found was that by preparing for war, that the powers inclined themselves. They increased the probability that war would come. And from the very apex of power in both Beijing and Washington, all the way down the chain of command, both powers are preparing for war. The leaders are making statements, and their commanders are following in line with preparations for war. And that greatly increases the probability of conflict breaking out.
Well, Alfred McCoy, I wanted to ask you, in terms of this whole issue, and we're seeing it portrayed repeatedly in the U.S. press as China as a rising aggressive power in the world. Now, I confess I have a lot of problems understanding this when you look at the record. From what I can tell, the last three times that China's military went outside of its borders were back in the 1950s and 60s, and there was Korea. There was a brief war in 62 with India, a border war. There was a 1979 border war with Vietnam that China participated in. Meanwhile, since that time, by my count, the United States invaded Grenada in 83, in 1990, Panama. In 1991, the first Gulf War. In 1999, the attack, the air war on Serbia. In 2001, Afghanistan. In 2003, Iraq. There's the Libya bombings, the U.S. intervention in Syria. So how is China being portrayed by our media and by the Western powers as the aggressive power in the world these days?
When the United States has been the dominant power in the world for 75 years, for the past 30 years, we've essentially been the world's sole superpower. So from that perspective, any challenge is a serious challenge. And China is the first power that's become capable of mounting that challenge. And in that sort of process of U.S. hegemony, the threat to Taiwan is serious. One of the keys to American global power has been what the Chinese call the first island chain. We call it the Pacific Littoral. At the start of the Cold War back in the 1950s, the United States had five mutual security agreements starting in Japan, going through South Korea, Taiwan, the Philippines, and Australia. And that is the fulcrum of U.S. global power, enabling the United States to defend one continent, North America, and dominate another, the vast continent of Eurasia. And so apart from everything else, the loss of Taiwan would break that geopolitical chain that is the fulcrum for U.S. global defense and threaten to push the United States back to what's called the second island chain, essentially running from Japan through Guam and further south. And so from a geopolitical perspective, China represents both, first of all, by its sheer size of its military, the second largest, the size of its economy, by many estimations now the world's largest, a major threat, the first real threat to U.S. global power in over 30 years.
But hasn't the United States, to a large degree, basically helped the enormous economic development of China by all of the U.S. companies that made China the manufacturing center of the world, invested there, built their factories there, and used the cheap products of China to keep providing a better standard of living for people in the West? So isn't the U.S. in a sense responsible in large degree for this economic rise of China?
Well, first of all, the Chinese have done it themselves. But what the United States has done has admitted China as a full member of the global economy. Look, when the history of the American empire is written, and scholars trying to find some of the key decisions that Americans made, American leaders made, that doomed the U.S. empire to defeat, one of the things they're going to, I think, focus on is back in 2001, there was a bipartisan decision by leaders of both Republican and Democratic Party to admit China to the World Trade Organization. Now, this was essentially an organization that mediated trade among comparable industrial powers. And for the first time, this enormous developing nation was admitted to the World Trade Organization as a full trading partner. And they then used it kind of like Pac-Man to just gobble up the world's industry. And now China is the world's premier industrial power, with twice the industrial capacity of the United States, larger than any other industrial power on the planet. And that's largely due to the admission of China to the World Trade Organization. At the time it was done, Washington, in a supreme act of imperial hubris, thought that China would play the global game by America's clearly written rules, all right? That they would become a nice, compliant, cuddly, big panda bear China. Okay? Our nice little toy that would produce our toys for our economy at low-cost prices. And it clearly hadn't happened that way. China is a great power. It is arguably the world's most powerful empire throughout history. And China, from its perspective, is simply recovering its rightful place as the leader of the world.
So we wanted to address what's happened over the last few weeks with these extremely blunt statements of China. The Chinese President Xi directly accused the United States of suppressing China's development in what the Wall Street Journal described as a, quote, unusually blunt rebuke of U.S. policy. She said, Western countries, led by the U.S., have implemented all-round containment, encirclement, and suppression against us, bringing unprecedentedly severe challenges to our country's development. Xi's comments came just days after the Chinese Foreign Ministry issued a nearly 4,000-word report condemning U.S. foreign policy since the end of World War II. The Chinese Foreign Ministry's report began, since becoming the world's most powerful country after the two world wars and the Cold War, the United States has acted more boldly to interfere in the internal affairs of other countries, pursue, maintain, and abuse hegemony, advance subversion and infiltration, and willfully wage wars, bringing harm to the international community. The Chinese Foreign Ministry went on to say about the U.S., quote, it has overstretched the concept of national security, abused export controls, and forced unilateral sanctions upon others. It's taken a selective approach to international law and rules, utilizing or discarding them as it sees fit, and has sought to impose rules that serve its own interests in the name of upholding a rules-based international order. So There's a lot there. The new foreign minister, the foreign ministry statement, Xi himself now saying that they're going to increase their military budget by something like 7% this year. Talk about this change and how you see this playing out.
Sure. We haven't seen rhetoric, anti-American rhetoric, coming from Beijing really since the early 1960s when Mao Zedong became furious with Moscow because during the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, China wanted Russia to launch nuclear strikes on the United States from its missile installations in Cuba. And that was one of the contributing factors, among many, but still one contributing factor to the final rupture between China and Russia that caused the famous Sino-Soviet split. So we haven't seen rhetoric like this in 60 years, okay? ever since the United States recognized China in 1979 diplomatically, generally the rhetoric has been very polite, very circumscribed. So this is all part of the rising tensions over Taiwan. In many ways, when you unpack most of those Chinese statements, what you find is what they're really talking about is the U.S. is challenging China's claim to Taiwan as being an integral part of the Chinese state. And indeed, President Biden, in one of his four statements last year, probably the most provocative statement, said that that Taiwan alone should determine its independence. And that was a fundamental rupture on what has been known as the One China policy. When we recognized China diplomatically in 1979, it has been bipartisan U.S. policy under Republican and Democratic presidents, and you can go through every single one who said it, all of them were opposed to Taiwan independence. They said there's one China. The qualifier in that was that the United States did not want the People's Republic to resolve the issue by force. But the United States, every American president since the recognition of China over 40 years ago, has been absolutely consistent. You know, Taiwan is a part of China. There is one China. And President Biden's statement that Taiwan should determine its own independence is a real rupture, a real break with that bipartisan foreign policy. And China has responded in kind. Last October at the 20th Party Congress, Xi Jinping made a phenomenal statement. He said that the wheels are turning to reunify Taiwan with China. And what he was referring to was these dialectical forces, Marxian dialectical forces, that inevitably mean that Taiwan will become integrated with China. And as the political philosopher Hannah Arendt taught us, that when authoritarian states like China speak in terms of inevitability, that's when they're capable of waging, conducting unspeakable atrocities, mass murders, or plunging into unwinnable wars. So, on both sides, we're seeing very sharp rhetoric that's part of that process of the preparing the United States and China for war over Taiwan.
And I wanted to ask you, if such a war were to break out, I'm wondering your sense of how the reaction in other parts of the world, especially the global South, in view of the enormous expenditures that China has made in its Belt and Road Initiative in countries throughout Africa, Latin America, India, and other parts of the world. How would the global South respond to such a conflict?
Well, first of all, it would depend on the way the war broke out, okay? There are a number of think tanks that have been wargaming a possible U.S.-China war over Taiwan. One scenario is that China would simply impose a customs blockade, saying that this is our sovereign territory and that nobody can sail directly to Taiwan. You have to call first by aircraft or by ship on China or some similar pronouncement and then ring the island with ships and submarines and aircraft to block all communication. Now, if that were to happen, China could do that very quickly in a matter of hours. And that would mean the United States, in order to break that blockade, would have to mobilize its fleets from Honolulu and Yokosuka in Japan and sail and attack the Chinese ships sailing in what they claim to be their own territorial waters. That would mean that the United States is attacking China. We would, under those circumstances, no matter what we'd say, to the world, we would look like an aggressor, right? That we're attacking Chinese ships in what is, by China's standard, indeed by international standards, China's territorial waters surrounding Taiwan. And so right from the start, in the global south, we would be seen to be an aggressor. We'd probably carry Europe with us under the NATO alliance. But beyond that, it would be very, very difficult diplomatically for the United States. Now, by contrast, if the other most extreme scenario is that China launches a lightning, massive amphibious invasion across the Taiwan Strait. China has 2,900 aircraft. They have now the world's largest navy. They have ample capacity for such an operation. That capacity increases every day. You know, now, in some scenarios,